Hello and welcome again to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, a systems foresight series provided by Shushum Works and evolved from our collaboration with NASA's Convergent Aeronautic Solutions Project. I'm Diane Finkhausen, and today we're exploring how to orchestrate multiple technologies into working ecosystems, using energy as the example today, but very applicable to any complex transformation. We're joined today by Dr. Jalal Hayes, who earned his PhD in chemistry at 22, the youngest in the United States, and who now runs Events, a hydrogen storage company, while also teaching at Lincoln University. He works on three different fuel technologies simultaneously, and rather than picking one winner, he's developed frameworks for actually making them work together. So whether you're in aerospace, healthcare, manufacturing, or government, the challenges of orchestration are remarkably similar. So very excited about the conversation today. Dr. Hayes, maybe if you wouldn't mind taking just a couple of minutes to walk our listeners through a little bit of your background and your focus areas, and then we can dive in.
Absolutely. So first of all, thank you so much, Diane, for having me today on this podcast. I'm deeply honored. So essentially what I do now is I like to frame things in terms of the three E's, energy, education, the overall entrepreneurship. So as you probably stated before, energy is, I'm focusing on hydrogen storage as well as what different types of mediums we could look at in terms of hydrogen storage, which I'll get into later. I look at most three. Also, the education part, you did state that I am a professor at Lincoln. If not, I am a professor at Lincoln University of Pennsylvania. I'm associate professor there. In addition to that, before that, I started out as a high school teacher. So education is very dear and near to my heart, because I came from two parents that are educators, and I continued down that path, but I did it differently because I focused on STEM education, and I also like to say applications, with a focus on, as I stated before, energy. And that's where the entrepreneurship comes in, which is the last E. So essentially making sure that an entrepreneurship is very special in the way that I look at it in regards to taking education that we learn in the classroom and applying it out into the real world. And so I have this, I guess, this nuanced title that I like to call myself, a academic entrepreneur, which is a title that's been out in literature for quite some time. And that particular title means that I focus on the academy, publishing papers and articles, but the entrepreneurship, the entrepreneur, is I try to translate that for my students on how it can be applicable to solving real world problems. So that's a little bit of what I do. Energy, I know that we have questions. We have a conversation on how we get into that. And we also talked about a conversation on that previously. But essentially, that's how, in a nutshell, who I am. I'm part of a framework, which is 3E.
I love that framework. It really, you're blending a lot of the core themes, ecosystemic themes that we have tackled throughout this series. But you're blending them into one integrated real world learning program, which is really the experience that your students are going to experience for the rest of their careers, because we're now in very much a constant learning environment with the pace and change of innovation. So I love that you're setting that up in their learning experience with you. So let's maybe start there and double click into that 3E framework, energy, education, and entrepreneurship. Again, just to repeat, happening simultaneously rather than sequentially. For our listeners here who are, in many cases, leading transformation efforts, innovation efforts, launching new product lines, building research programs, developing regional initiatives, how do you recommend that our listeners basically build out this expertise, this superpower, kind of thinking across these three change dimensions in what they do? How do they balance that for the change that they're introducing to the world, the innovation that they're introducing to the world?
Absolutely. So for 3E, that's more of a framework for me, because all of the things start out with E's. You just luckily came up with that. But there is a framework on how you can actually can streamline everything in terms of different dimensions. If you look at education as a whole, I think specifically in STEM education, there's a pedagogy that's been around for, I think, the last 20 years, and it's called the CURE. CURE stands for the Course for Undergraduate Research Experience, meaning that this particular mindset, this particular focus has been looking at, okay, how we could take a course, which is in education, whether you're in, they started this out in college, but you can apply this in middle school, high school, and college, and even graduate school. But they started out in the undergraduate study to say, okay, our students, we need to get them engaged in STEM activity and get them engaged fast, because as you stated, Diane, there is a innovation is happening so fast and so swiftly in our world, not just in the US, but in our world, that the next generation of STEM leaders have to get the ball running. And so this CURE method was designed to we're not just learning about theory, but we also going to simultaneously practice this particular focus. I just done it in energy. That's where my 3E framework came in. Whereas I started out with education, just teaching the students concepts of chemistry, concepts of physics, and even a little bit of biology in terms of what is just the fundamentals. And then from there, okay, we learn the fundamentals, guys. Let's focus on your other styles of learning, which is audio, visual, and tactile, or kinesthetic, which is hands-on learning. And we can apply that in the real world. Now, science is very simple because you got lab courses, right? But what we've done and what has been done in the research is that individuals, researchers, professors, faculty has been taking that, and instead of just doing fundamental concepts or fundamental concepts in the lab, they changed the lab concepts into solving real world problems. So in the education world, it's called problem-based learning, picking a specific problem and saying, okay, class, this is the problem that we're going to solve. And we're going to use the rest of the course time in solving it. So for my instance, I just pick energy because that's my field of study. In biology, it can be drug discovery, or we're looking at this particular drug, how can it solve this particular problem? And even you probably see this over, if we take it out of science and business, which you have case study competitions, right? So this particular study is not really novel. I just streamlined it into the way my brain works, and seeing, okay, how I can't just teach y'all what's happening in the classroom on a, like, in terms of chemistry, general chemistry, physical chemistry, even a little bit of biochemistry. I could teach y'all the concepts in the class, but I think it'll be better if y'all actually learn it in real time as I'm teaching it. Because let's face it, we know we're doing that. And you stated this before, Diane, there is a constant learning happening in the world. Even when you graduate from college, even when you graduate high school, there's a constant learning that this cycle is constantly going to go. I just took that cycle that I've learned being a little bit in industry, being a little bit in government, and being fully now in education, and just applied it in the classroom. And that's where the framework came in.
Yeah, that's so important for tomorrow's leaders to build out that capacity, that capability, that will serve them well. And you're doing a great service to help them translate that, right? So the solving real world problems and problem-based learning, as they step into the real world, as you know, they're going to be leading problem-based innovation, they're going to be translating between learning, sensing the changes in the markets and the environments around them, solving those problems and then applying those for the path forward. So that translation function, sensing, sense making, and seizing is going to be a constant as they step into their careers. So So great, great work there. If we kind of pull that thread a little bit more, you know, these are frameworks for how to think about problem solving, kind of applying what we are learning, our assumptions, and then applying those to real world problems. There are a lot of challenges that they face in the real world environment. So let's maybe kind of double click into some of your energy research and work. So if we take your LOHC technology, liquid organic hydrogen carriers, stores hydrogen without needing the expensive specialized equipment. You can use existing fuel infrastructure with this, and that's a fundamentally different design choice than saying, you know, hydrogen needs cryogenic tanks and building an entirely new infrastructure.
Yep.
So when you're kind of working on these types of problems, how do you think about the trade-off between revolutionary new systems versus evolutionary improvement of existing systems? Is there a framework for deciding, or is it case by case? This fundamental challenge is faced by innovators and change makers everywhere.
Absolutely. So when I think about evolutionary versus revolutionary, I think about this a lot. When you're talking about evolutionary, that's talking about incremental change, seeing over time. You may not see it until 20 years from now what society is adopted. When you're talking about revolutionary change, that's disrupting the market within the next 5, maybe 10 years, right? So the way I look at this is I look at what's the problem in the world now, not just the immediate problem, like on a technical level, but where is our mindset at right now? What is actually needed right now that the world may not see, but I, as an innovator, entrepreneur, can see? And one, is the world ready for that? My first question, one, is the world ready for that? And then two, if they're not ready, me being a professor, is there a way I could teach them that this is an easier way compared to the way that they've been used to? So when I'm looking at revolutionary, it got to not only disrupt, but it got to be easier than what we've done before. Kind of like if we go back to the camera. When the camera first was invented, you know, they started out with a film and you had everybody hold still and they flashed. It was a whole process. Then they flashed the film, then they had to reload it and things of that nature. To now, you could just take a picture on your phone and you have it done in milliseconds. Snap, snap. So the world back then wasn't ready for a phone technology, but if it would have happened 5 to 10 years from that moment and say, hey, instead of doing 10 minutes of photo, we can do 5 milliseconds of photo, that would have revolutionized the camera back then. So I think they weren't ready because at that time, you got to think about them being ready because at that time, I think electricity was just coming around. So is more of those two part questions. Are they ready for it? And if they are ready for it or not ready for it, will they make their process easy? So everything is a learning curve when you looking about that, in terms of revolutionary and evolutionary. I probably lost sight of the question. Can you repeat the question one more time?
No, you nailed it. Actually, you nailed it. The question. So, the question was, how do you think about basically the trade-off between revolutionary new systems and versus evolutionary improvement of existing systems? And is there a framework for deciding, or is it case by case? And I think you, nailed it. Go ahead.
No, to agree with you, it is that, okay. I think it is a case by case, but right now it looks at it from a framework of everything is so blurred in together that I think it's the former rather than the case by case latter, because before everything was separated, but now, like, for example, AI and energy are hand in hand at this point.
Right.
And people will say, well, how is that possible? Because when you're building data centers, you need energy to run the data centers. So it doesn't even matter if it's clean energy, dirty energy. We need energy in a nutshell. So how we're going to solve the problem of the AI thing. So it's the former in this time period rather than the case by case and previous revolutions. In this revolution, when we talk about internet industry, we in the internet industry ecosystem where we're scaling up on what the internet or technology electronics can look like, everything is blurred together. So it's the former thing that you stated, not the latter.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally makes sense. Totally makes sense. And you really kind of made this point or at least alluded to it. So you're designing these technologies for ships, planes, trucks, power plants, remote operations, vastly different environments, operating contexts, use cases. So a shipping company and an airline have almost nothing in common. Well, very little in common operationally. So how do you design something that works across such different contexts without just creating kind of a compromise that's not great for everyone or anyone?
It starts with just asking your customers, what is the biggest, what is their biggest problem? And then from that standpoint, seeing if the technology, asking everybody what their problems are, and then looking at your technology and seeing on a high level, do everybody has the same problem? And can my solution or my technology solve that problem? When it comes to energy, realistically, everybody want reliable energy. It's all about energy security and resilience. That's the umbrella on what everybody needs are. Now, how do they get that energy security and resilience? That's where it can get tricky in terms of the specifications of the technology. So for LOHC, the reason why I look at that in terms of a broad range, because right now, electricity costs is very high, and the way you process the current technologies is very costly as well. That's why the price is high in terms of oil, coal, and things of that nature because of the low supply. But the LOHC, what I've looked at is it can be an alternative. Like people say hydrogen is the green diesel, but I think in terms of hydrogen being the green diesel, what does that look like? And that's what the biggest thing in the U.S., they're looking at what does that look like and how can that be affordable to everyone? I'm looking at LOHCs, liquid organic hydrogen carriers, as a possible solution because, one, that particular functionality on how you prepare it and application-wise is similar to the function of putting gas in a tank now. It's the same process, different fuel, same pump. So because I'm looking at it from that standpoint, now we're just testing in terms of the LOHC, in terms of your point, how efficient it is in different markets. That's where it gets tricky. Like, can it, for a standalone tech, for like a maritime shipping, which in this case, we're just focusing on the docks, not the ship itself. That means it's a standing technology, meaning that it's like backup power. So we utilize it for backup power, which means it's not going to be used all the time. We'll be efficient in that realm. If we're talking about looking at planes, it's going to be used frequently. So it's going to burn at a certain rate, at flow rate, like gas is burning at a certain rate in our car. Will it meet that particular demand or exceed that demand? That's where things get a little tricky. But in our lab, we're trying to figure out how we can find that balance. Like how oil solves the majority of the problems, we hope that LOHCs can solve the same problems as oil is doing so that we can ultimately replace it. Again, different fuel, same pump, but it's a cleaner fuel.
Nice.
Same pump.
Yeah, pretty elegant. Love that. Love that. Maybe switching gears a little bit and take a look at this on kind of a time scale, too, because so much of what you're doing is a kind of assessing where we are today, but then taking a look at how that infrastructure or ecosystem might evolve into something that's cleaner or better, but do so in a way that is it's an elegant transition from the sounds of it. So if we maybe think about the timeline, you know, for the next 3 years versus the next three decades, some of these innovations are going to be maybe maturing in the short term. Some won't mature until beyond 2030. And that's a kind of a decade scale orchestration where different pieces move at different speeds, have different kind of interdependencies. For our listeners who might be managing transformation that spans years or decades, we see that a lot in the space ecosystem, which is, you know, really maturing. Whether it's energy defense, space defense modernization, healthcare system integration, how do you maintain coherence when components develop asynchronously? Yeah. What are some of your go-to tools or practices, methodologies?
Well, I would put it in steps. The first step I would do is see what my customer that, if you're still, and this is for the listeners out there, because I love this question. The first thing for those who are building a decade technology and they try and do things in years 3 to 5, figure out who's the customer that you want to get in contact with and build a relationship. I think customer relationships are very important, specifically as an entrepreneur, in regards to connecting to that customer before you even have a maturity of the technology. It's because business is a people's game, not a meritocracy game, as a lot of people may think it is. It is meritocracy, but it's like 50-50, people and meritocracy. So with that being said, make sure you build that customer relationship first. So for example, I can give an example of what we did at events. Before we knew it was maritime, we built relationships with various industries across the energy sector that may need, or we thought may need, our technology. And this is for our first technology, which is the metal hydride. We looked at space. We looked at aerospace or airplanes. We also looked at maritime. We looked at agriculture. We looked at all these various industries. And that's before digging deep into the technology. How we landed on maritime was based on what the literature was stating. So, of course, as a scientist, I got to see what my scientific community is saying in regards to relationship to my technology, as well as what I see technology. And then from which stated from our technology, which is the metal hydride battery, or the metal hydride battery, it stated that maritime will probably be the best fit. And because of our TRL level, which is at a 5, now we officially went over to a 6 as of 2 weeks ago, with a pilot study.
For our listeners, can you explain what TRL is?
Absolutely. So TRL, which is technology readiness level, is a scale that was developed greatly by NASA, because they came up with this when they launched, when they start launching rockets into space. So it is essentially, it's a scale to see from idea to marketplace. So think of, and the scale goes from 1 to 9. 1 meaning that you stating, hey, I got an idea. Let me write it on a napkin. This is great. I think it's going to change the world. To 9 saying, wow, I'm looking at my product on the shelf, or wow, the Department of Defense, or I think now it's called Department of War, has bought my technology and now is helping make a impact into whatever the market need is. So think of how, and I'll give this scenario as well. I don't know if y'all like this guy, but I'm going to still use this, the guy I look up to. So it's like Steve Jobs saying, I want to change the world with a computer. That's TRL1. To now him being on stage and say, behold, look at the Apple II. It goes on sale tomorrow.
Yeah.
There's steps in between that. One through nine, I'm just giving a short version, but essentially where I'm at five signifies saying, hey, you built the technology, but nobody really knows about it yet. We want to know if this actually can work in the real field. So that's where you did the lab work is great in the lab. It looks amazing in the lab. Can we make this in the real world? And so that's where I'm at. I'm at the part where I did everything in the lab, is validated in the lab. Everybody's excited in the lab. But now I got to take it out the lab and see if it can actually operate in the real world based on what the lab studies say.
Yep. Get some field demos and exercises going. Yeah,
exactly.
And then do you run like integration checkpoints or regular reviews with your customers?
Yeah. So I do integration checkpoints. I run regular reviews with my customers and also seeing that do it solve other problems they may have concerns with. So, for example, in the maritime industry, what we found out is with our technology, it wasn't just an energy problem. It was also another an emissions problem. So when you're dealing with cruise lines, you're dealing with cargo ships, the boat sits there for a very long time, right? And while sitting there, the boat is still running. So a lot of emissions going in the air. A lot of that stuff, because they was using ammonia technology for the clean fuel, they was concerned that ammonia was going into the atmosphere. And what a lot of people don't realize, some people live, there's dock city. So people live around that particular area. Or if it's a cruise line ship, people are waiting and the boat is running and you got ammonia going up in the air. And that's not good for not just the environment, but people in that place, in that point of time. We showed that our technology not only does power, but can lock in. And I'm just saying specifically that technology can lock in the ammonia. So double header, which helps out with the checkpoints as well. Not just saying that we help power something, but we also help clean the air and the environment based on EPA standards, American Environment Protection Agency standards, yeah. That chemical.
Nice, nice. And that those kinds of benefits and value are only really evolved out of that close customer centricity and that problem-centric innovation and problem-centric learning.
Yes.
That you described earlier. So, you know, really important lessons for our listeners. And I'd love to circle back to something you mentioned a short while ago as well. You talked about the people, right? And this also reconnects with your learning work, right? Your teaching work. But all this technology, commercial work requires people who can actually do it.
Yes. Right?
And when you're working on revolutionary innovation, then there's a massive education component to that. So let's maybe talk about building that knowledge ecosystem. Yes. Around and bringing not only kind of the contributors, but also policymakers along with you as you're learning, as you're developing, as you're launching. How does that, what are some of your frameworks or your methodologies to build out that knowledge ecosystem and bring the key stakeholders along with you in that process?
Absolutely. I will say a quote that my mentor taught me about 10 years ago when I started teaching. He said, assume people do not know anything. That's how you can gauge to help everybody learn everything and you vice versa. Meaning that when this, I could speak, I'm a hydrogen expert for disclosure. When the hydrogen boom happened in 2020, one, then it hit our state. I'm located in Delaware, the first state in the United States. When it hit this particular state, there was a whole, when we got our hydrogen hub, we had a mid-Atlantic. When we got our hydrogen hub for the first time, a lot of people was asking, what is hydrogen? What's going on? And even policymakers, knowledge seekers, who everybody was jumping on to this particular concept of hydrogen. I want to remind people, it wasn't broken down how it was back in 2004, where there were fuel cells, this, this, and this. It was literally just hydrogen. So it was a blanket statement, meaning that I love that because everybody can get into what was actually happening, whether it was policymakers, government officials who was learning about how to deal with expenditures, even the technical leaders like myself, entrepreneurs, people who were switching things over to green at the time. They was trying to truly understand what hydrogen is. And that's where the learning curve comes in, where you have to actually teach from the ground level what is hydrogen on a fundamental chemistry. You don't have to have a chemistry degree, sidebar, but the fundamental chemistry principles of hydrogen, and then scale up to how does it apply to each and everybody life from a political standpoint, to a technical standpoint, and to a academic standpoint as well, because the next generation of leaders have to keep this economy going. This is literally like a bubble. So what I would say is it's all learning experience. And at events, we have a slogan that we go by. We're a research and development company. We focus on two T's, tech and talent. We research and develop technology, but we also research and develop talent. So when you're referring to that knowledge ecosystem, we don't have a culture of, oh, you don't know hydrogen well. Let me speak to somebody that does. Or let me connect to a customer that, or give me somebody that's already familiar with what we're saying. We're looking at customers and policymakers and stakeholders all over and saying, well, let's go through this learning experience on what it is, what it can do, and also how it can help you from a standpoint. And then that's where, like you and I having right now, Diane, we go through a dialogue. We don't do lecture style. We do conversation style when we're dealing with all of our stakeholders. So that's naturally how at events we have this knowledge, community knowledge ecosystem, because everybody feels like they belong, whether it's hydrogen or some other technology that we work in, because we come in from a, like I told you the quote before, understand that we all know nothing, or we at the ground zero, and we're scaling up our economy of knowledge as we go through this journey together. So that's what I've done in the state of Delaware, where I just assume people just don't know what I'm talking about, because I know I can get into jargon a lot. So I just assume people don't know what I'm talking about. And then from there, we scale up knowledge. And I learned, well, what do you do? Oh, I'm a policymaker. We're trying to pass laws on how to do this clean energy credit. Oh, okay. What made you interested in hydrogen? So it's very conversational. And then if you want to get technical, we can dig deep into the technical at a later conversation. But the goal is to hook everybody in, because everybody is a stakeholder, particularly in a budding economy like hydrogen, like even space, commercialized space. I think a lot of people don't know that's even becoming a budding economy, regardless of what you see what billionaires are doing. That is a budding economy where space is being commercialized and not just being just focus on government. So any budding economies is always going to be a knowledge ecosystem being built. And if you think like drugs, drug discoveries, like, oh, these are existing, there's always a startup mode in every type of economy. We just have to find it. And that's where you'll see the knowledge ecosystem flourish.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. So your education work is strengthening your innovation work and vice versa. It's a very strong translation function embedded in all that. I'd love to, if we could just talk about you specifically. It just really, at the risk of embarrassing you, you finished your PhD at 22, which is just extraordinary. So you really compressed typical learning development timeline. And I'd like to believe that that shows up in the way that you're engaging with your learners, with your students, and frankly, your stakeholders. So you're developing the next generation of professionals, but you're also developing the next generation of the hydrogen economy, right? So when you look at your graduate students and early career researchers, what actually distinguishes the ones who are able to kind of develop systems thinking, or better said, how are you developing that systems thinking with your learners, seeing across kind of the intersections between, as an example, chemistry, business, policy, technology, implementation, and how do you also encourage those that prefer to dive deep into learning about one narrow area? Because we need both. We need the folks who can be those broad system thinkers and kind of dot connectors, and those that are pursuing deep research in one narrow focus area. How do you discern, the strengths and kind of encourage those explorations and help them build those capabilities and ideally accelerate their own learning curves and learning journeys?
Absolutely. I think you stated it within the question, Diane. I just watch people. So that's the thing I do. So with my students, I watch their strengths. I look at their strengths. I really take a deep interest into their strengths. And then from there, and I do this also with our employees as well. I just look at what they're really good at naturally, and then I pull that out of them. Because again, when you're running a company, it's very different from running a lab. In a lab, everybody's technical, right? But when you're running a company, you realize you need everybody. And not just scientists. Scientists is the heart of the company, of course. Particularly if you have a research and development company, or if you have a clean energy company, or any type of company that is scientific, the scientists are the focus. That's great. But you need your marketers, which is your science communicators. You need your, like you say, your future policymakers. You need everybody, because all of that makes your company have an edge compared to your competitors or your peers within the industry. So I just observe my whole system. I designed a system like this, and I've been doing this since I started out in the classroom. I set people up in groups like I did in the classroom when I was a high school teacher. I set them into groups of four or five, and I watch who does what. When I give a task, problem-based learning, inquiry-based learning, we do a pedagogy in education. And I just watch who does what, who takes the notes, who's giving the directions based on who's reinforcing the directions based on what is written on the board. And then who actually implements. And from there, you see what are their strengths are. The implementers is going to be your technical individuals. They're not really talking, but if you give them a task, they'll do the work. If you have a person who's reinforcing information, your information, they probably better at communicating. Because I know as a teacher, I may say something, but the student or the employee may take it differently. So you have a reinforcing person who can communicate in a language that everybody receives. I'm the leader, but they're the influencer. Therefore, they're the science communicator or the marketer in their group. So I look at that. And then also, that's one. You got, okay, one is the communicator. That's the reinforcer. That's the first person. You may have two people that are the technical implementers. And then you have another person that may not be as technical, but may not want to lead. But when it comes to the writing, they know how to write something that can persuade and engage people. That's your policymaker. So I look at that, or that person that communicates with government relations. So I look at that in terms of my students, in terms of that framework, and say, okay, this is the system that's flowing with each group. That's from an education standpoint. But I took that same thinking from 10 years ago and I applied it into the company. Who is good at what? So for example, I use this all the time. My co-founder, he's the COO. He's the COO of my company, and he's also a project manager. But you know what his strength is? He can make anybody laugh and anybody make them enjoy themselves. It don't matter what room he in. He just asks questions that make people open up.
Nice.
And it just vibes out. So he's more of, so because I see that, I put him in a role that's more government relations as well as COO, because he know how to get people engaged. I'm more of the CEO, which is I know how to get the task done, but I also see what the vision is of the company in terms of reinforcing. So I get people going. Mm-hmm. Or the vibe guy. And then my general counsel, both of us combined. So he's the right hand. So it's just, so when you look at that from that standpoint, you just see how people operate, and then you put them in where their strengths are, and it works out well, because to them, when you do that, it never feels like work.
Yeah.
It won't get stressed, which that's what startup.
Yeah. So smart. So smart. And, you know, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about, you know, really elegant and informed kind of strategic resource allocation, right? And at a person level, but then also you're applying that, obviously at an investment level, right? So if we think about how that frameworks or those frameworks actually work, at the operating level, and although we could really dive into this, into the chemistry, but, what I'd like to maybe have you, kind of think through with our listeners here, how the systems thinking operates, right? So if we take these strategic resource allocation kind of frameworks and apply them to the investments that you're making. So you maintain four different approaches to producing biohydrogen simultaneously. And keep me honest here, Dr. Hayes, but mm-hmm. using bacteria in darkness, bacteria with light, algae, and electrically assisted fermentation. Is that correct? So most organizations would pick a bet and they would lean into that and focus their resources on the bet that that they have a high degree of confidence in, for whatever reason. Why do you keep all four in play? And what's the framework for determining when this, you know, diversity of approaches fosters resilience versus actually creating dilutive focus and slowing others down? How do you maintain that balance?
I look at it as, I think the way I maintain the balance, I think it comes from, again, when I was a scientist, I focused on everything. But man, when I switched on education, I mean, I focused everything on one thing. But when I got an education, it started broadening my mindset on how to handle different things. So I'll say to answer that question, I charge it all to the education industry or the education sector. When I was in education, we had this concept called differentiated learning and instruction, meaning that I had to teach everybody the same lesson. But everybody learns 30 different ways because it's 30 different students in the class, right? So how do you get this achieved goal? Mm-hmm. Look at what is, it's all like a distribution curve. You look at who will be your early adopters, which is the smart, the people who just want to get it. And I'm getting to the point as well. Look at people who smart who won't get it. You look at the people who's going to take their time, not so much get it as much. That's at the end of the curve. And then in the middle, you got the average people that you know, this is the expectation. I look at research the same way. And those four ways can contribute to four different industry needs. So for example, for dark fermentation, that can apply to somebody who don't have access to sun, like as much. So let's say, and producing biohydrogen. So let's say like London, where the sun is not shining so bright, or the UK, the sun is not shining so bright. So the light production, and I'm just breaking it down in terms of biohydrogen. I'm just want to make it simple for the users. There's light and there's dark production. And then you got acid production, but I just want to focus light and dark. Light, biohydrogen produces with UV light. Dark, it produces without UV light. That simple. Now, if you want to get into nitty gritty, be my guest. Go ahead, research, do your chemical literature. I'm not doing that today. So in terms of the light part, that will work in a place like Africa where the sun is shining all the time and constantly, and it goes down. It's not very intermittent. The sun is evidently there. The dark fermentation will happen at the United Kingdom, where the sun is very gloomy, so you won't get the sun as often unless you go there in the summertime. So I look at those particular processes based on a case by case scenario, because one may not work in one region, but it will work for the other region. Mm-hmm. And honestly, that's why it's very hard to adopt these clean energy technologies, because all these technologies is not a streamline. It's literally a case by case or region by region scenario. And that's why I keep the lines open, because when it comes to clean energy technologies or what we call renewables, it's always a case by case scenario. It's not until you design an all in one with these technologies, you integrate them all together, that you may get a streamlined solution. But right now, with the knowledge that we have, these are case by case. And that's why I keep all of them open, because it's determined by what problem I'm solving for that particular area.
Yeah, totally makes sense. Totally makes sense. And throughout the conversation here, you've emphasized that as you just stated, your technologies aren't competing alternatives, but they have a synergistic or convergent pathways that can work together, if orchestrated, thoughtfully, right? So, for our listeners, a lot of organizations will instinctively think, which one should we bet on, as I mentioned earlier, rather than how do they combine or how do they overlay the unique problem sets of our stakeholders in the markets that we serve. So as you just described, I think really, really well for our listeners, take them to the next step. For someone who's listening, who's evaluating technological strategies in any domain, not just energy, what has to change in how they think, and what's that mental shift, maybe even from competition to ecosystemic kind of methodology?
I would say the first step is that we're going to go scientific method on this. The first step, I would say, let's look at step one in the scientific method for all of us. I may be wrong based on various schools, but the first one is purpose. What are we trying to accomplish here? We say save energy. We want a better drug. We want this, but what is the purpose that we're trying to achieve? What is the problem we're actually trying to solve? And then from there, that ties in with the question, right? How, the what, the where, the how, you ask that question, and then you come up with an hype. No. You go purpose. I'm skipping a step. You go purpose. And then after the purpose, the second step, and then I'm going to pause there, is the observations. We have to look right now, as I'm looking in the scientific world, particularly economic world, the United States is looking more regional and local when it comes to technologies, economic development, and resources. That's the best way to put it. I noticed that back when I was visiting MIT. I'm seeing it now in my state in Delaware, and where I'm from originally, Pennsylvania. I'm seeing that as well. Because of that, everybody within your region, within the region, needs to observe who has what. Like, for example, what we did with our technology. and what I'm very proud of over at events, we not only develop our prototype and that is industry grade, but the industries all are located in the state, if not the region. So we built everything within Delaware and Pennsylvania. That helps out, and that's a win-win, and let me explain why. One, it helps the policymakers work hand-in-hand instead of taking everything to the federal level. Nothing wrong with the federal level, but you keep state by state, so it's easier. You develop relationships better, and the cost for the entrepreneur and as well as the end user, the customer, is cheaper. So I think we really need to, and I'm saying that just for us in the energy, but I know it's way easier probably in the pharmaceutical industry. It might be even way easier in other industries because you don't have an infrastructure issue like energy. Even in the AI industry, whereas data centers, there has to be a way where we all look and observe and say, okay, what are our strengths are and how can we pull our strengths together within the region so that we can influence the policymakers on what can work for us economically, efficiently, and overall communally to get us in a better society. Because that's the issue. I see the overarching issue is the policymakers trying to understand what the technical people are saying. The technical people is frustrated with the business people because they don't think the business people understand what's going on in the industry. So it's a lack of communication. So we all got to just stop, observe what each of us are doing, and then communicate with one another, build a team amongst each other. Then we approach it to a policy side so we can get things going.
Yeah, really great synthesis. We find ourselves in this series talking a lot about just very, very broadly, if you'll forgive me, with the degree to which our world is interconnected, right? And the pace and amplitude of change that we see flowing through. We see, you know, oversimplifying, but we see innovation, is the first wave. Adoption is the second wave. And oftentimes policy is the third and lagging wave. And depending on kind of the situation, the chasm between those waves, can be quite big. So the more the innovators, the foresight folks, the researchers, the innovators, the change makers, can kind of very thoughtfully bring the policymakers along with them in that journey, the learning journey, the innovation process. The closer that alignment, the better the governance framework will be, and the more beneficial our ecosystemic futures will be. And I'm afraid there we're going to have to wrap it up there, but Dr. Hayes, this has just been a brilliant and very kind of strong learning experience for me, and I'm sure for our listeners. So thank you so much for joining us. This is brilliant. I love your 3E framework, the beautiful dance that you have established between your innovation and your education work. And I just I know that our listeners will be able to draw a lot from your examples and your work. So for our listeners, please do. I would strongly recommend that you follow Dr. Hayes' work at Events Incorporated and connect with him at Lincoln University. And of course, as always, do definitely keep in touch with us. Follow our episodes, and you can always learn more at shoshamworks.com. But Dr. Hayes, thank you so much. This has been a brilliant conversation, and we're grateful for your perspective here today.
Always, and thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yep, absolutely. We will definitely be in touch. And for everyone, thank you again for your time today. Follow us, follow Dr. Hayes, and we'll bring you more great perspectives at ecosystemic futures and shoshimeworks.com. Take care.